as the cases I've heard about, to when foster parents have disagreed with the adoption planning of the agency, then they've gone in and asked for temporary custody under this statute. Is that, it's kind of a complicated process.
Well, I still don't see why 3 years is, I guess I don't see why there should be a time period there before that foster parent can have access for some kind of a relationship which a third party needs to decide in every case that's appropriate. So I just still not seeing the point.
Okay, further questions from committee or council?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, if I could. Ma'am, for 5 years, my wife and I were foster parents. We didn't seek adoption because this young lady's family is alive in Vietnam. But I, too, am hard-pressed to see what happens between the 18th month and the 36th month that would make a great difference.
I guess what I would go back to is the federal law, Public Law 96272, for reunification of families, and the right that parents have to work towards having their children back home with them, and that, in fact, there is a substantial number of children who are able to be reunified with their family during that, after that 18-month period happens. I think we're still, in many cases, still actively working on reunification plans. And if foster parents were to come into court because they disagreed with the reunification plan, at 3 years, you're much less likely to be working towards reunification. At 18 months, we're more likely to still be involved in reunification. And for foster parents to go in and ask for temporary custody could very well develop a custody battle between the foster parents and the biological parents, or the foster parents and the agency. And the planning is yet for reunification, and they may disagree with that direction and haven't been able to resolve that other ways.
Okay. Further questions? Okay, well, I think if there's follow-up here, maybe you folks need to get around and visit with individual members. In the interest of full disclosure, I should note that my mother-in-law has run a foster home in Portland for 20 years, dealing mostly with adolescents. So I'm sure I'm going to get another opinion on this before it's over.
Okay.
So thank you all very much. Anyone else here on Senate Bill 586? Let's try to go to work session on some of the bills. I know there's some people here, and then we'll get to hearings on the other bills. What's the bill?
245.
Okay.
We'll also take care of 625 at the same time.
And 625, I guess they're sort of being considered together here. Where are we at, Council?
Mr. Chair, we have a set of amendments for 245. So the parties in 245 and 625 have got together and have are proposing a set of amendments which will take in the best aspects of both bills. At least that's what they've told me. I believe Mr. Linden is here from the Court Administrator's Office, Mr. Olson from the Oregon State Bar, and Commissioner Hansen from Multnomah County.
Okay, well, whoever's here on 245 and 625 to speak the amendments, front and center, please. Okay, it looks like we've got a new bill representing the Dash 1 amendments to 245. Who wants to speak as the proponents for the Dash 1 amendments? Commissioner Hansen, welcome. Are you here to carry this issue, or you got some assistance here you're going to call?
Well, I've got brilliant assistance. Fred Neal is somewhere behind me. But to bring it forward to start, basically what these amendments are the end of a lengthy and cooperative discussion between Multnomah County Courthouse officials, Juvenile Justice Center, discussions involving the Board of County Commissioners, the DA, the Bar Association, our presiding judge, and the sheriff. What these amendments will do is allow us a local option funding source to provide courthouse security for the Multnomah County facilities. The need for increased security is just absolutely there. Every few weeks we read nationally of a courthouse shooting, tremendous stress on our court system based usually from, in the lower courts, from domestic, domestic relations, juvenile cases, parental custody cases, divorce, those types of things seem to spark this, these incredibly tragic shootings that in the past have occurred both in Multnomah County and in Washington County most recently. This will enable us not only to have a local local source of funding, but it also prescribes a planning process that will allow each county that chooses this option to tailor a specific courthouse security plan for the varied courthouses and situations throughout the state. It's needed. Those of us at the grassroots level feel that we're sitting on a powder keg, that it is just a matter of time before we have one of these other needless tragedies that can be prevented with adequate security.
Okay, may we go ahead and take questions here, or should we hear from the other panelists first?
I was just...
Sarah Handy.
Just a quick question. 10% of monies. Yeah, have you done an analysis of it, or am I missing it, or how much would it give you enough?
We have two funding sources. One is a 25%, the option of a 25% increase to the filing fees on civil cases. The other is 10% of our community corrections dollars. That balances out to be probably, for Multnomah County, and I'm sure it varies from county to county, it would raise approximately $400,000 on filing fees and about $35,000 to $40,000 off of the...
I see. Okay. For Multnomah.
For Multnomah County.
Thank
how
you.
How it would fit in other counties, I have no idea.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Let's go ahead with the balance of our witnesses and see if there are more questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For your record, Bill Linden, State Court Administrator. Absolutely no disagreement with Commissioner Hansen's description of the need. In every courthouse in the state, we have accidents waiting to happen. We're content to send these amendments to the Ways and Means Committee for the discussion on the dollar side. The 25% surcharge statewide would raise $3.1 million, and the 10% county jail assessment contribution we think is in the $300,000 to $350,000 range. So if, as I said at the first hearing on this, if new court-related revenues are embraced this session, this will not be what we will recommend they be spent on. But if those options are foreclosed and we're left simply with some new revenues to devote to security, we're certainly not going to stand in the way of that. We would be looking at new revenues to do other things, mainly avoid some of the expenditure cuts that are in mind. But for now, we're content to keep this moving along until the discussion on the dollars can be had.
Well, Mr. Olson, that doesn't sound like much of a deal to me, but...
Mr. Chairman,
you ready to embrace this?
It's a much better deal than you had a few weeks ago, and I think there's been a lot of movement. The amendments suggest that there is now a plan. We're conceptually in support of that, and I think it'd be hard to go much beyond those conceptual agreements that we have. Something needs to be done. I won't reread our statement of March 1st, but the bar and its legislative committee is very strongly in support of doing something. Courthouse users in general, have risk and want something to be done, and I think lawyers in particular feel that way. And this moves us in that direction.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Well, we've got a few questions here. Senator Weber, then Senator Price.
Just put an idea on the table, and Senator Hanby, with the gun bill back in committee and the prohibition against concealed weapons in the courthouse, is this something we might want to consider as an alternative? My roamings around indicated to me there was more support for the no concealed weapons in court than there was for the school gun bill. Just as a point of information, something to think about.
I can respond to that. In Multnomah County, Judge Launder is already has the Multnomah County Courthouse posted as being as allowing no concealed weapons. What this does is actually give us the tools to make that effective. We'll be able to keep them out, and they are already banned by the presiding off. By the presiding.
Did I miss something in here? Is there an amendment in here to prohibit concealed weapon guns?
They're already, in Multnomah County, they're already...
But that's not
there's,
by statute.
There's 35.
That's
no.
by
that's,
rule. And yeah. my understanding yeah. is that there is a rule that the Chief Justice has approved. We've had discussion before about putting it in statute for different reasons.
Okay. Senator Weber, will you complete
yes.
that thought
Thank
or question?
You,
Senator Hanby?
I mean, I'd be, certainly it's up to the committee, you know, to do something like that. I can tell you it's a concern. I've had a great deal of phone calls on the courthouse issue also. Most of these people are not aware that they can't walk into the post office. They're certainly not going to abide by Multnomah's ordinance. They've challenged me with this much. And it's not just a concealed weapon. I've learned a lot these last several weeks. It could easily be a walking arsenal of concealed weapons on a body. It just floored me.
Okay, Senator Rasmussen, pardon me, you are next.
No problem, Mr. Chair. I'm new to this bill. Your amendments appear to me to be House Bill 3176. What's the status of House Bill 3176?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rasmussen, that bill is in House Judiciary Committee, has not been scheduled, and I believe that it will not be scheduled because if the Senate bills begin moving, I think that they'll defer action and wait for them to reach the House.
Okay.
Senator Hanby. I'm assuming this can be used for detection kinds of equipment.
Yes.
Dollars. Right. Now it's Lane is investigating. Multnomah is investigating detection mm-hmm. types of equipment. Is it not?
Actually, we've spent a considerable amount of time on developing a courthouse security plan and it would involve card locks on a lot of the doors, and metal detectors at the main entrance. And that probably the principal cost is the people that are going to man the metal detectors. They're expensive, but they're a fixed cost. But the operations of them go on forever.
Okay. Further questions? These witnesses, I guess we don't have a formal fiscal impact statement because it's only an amendment, not a bill, but I think the information you gave us, Mr. Linden, was what you would in turn supply to fiscal on this.
Mr. Chairman, we just supplied that this morning, but
okay.
You probably don't have it in your files yet for the reason you stated.
Okay.
I will move the amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Well, we're not. Are we in work session? I guess we are in work session. Sure. Senator Han, we have a couple other folks to hear from, I think. Mr. Snyder, Mr. Williamson. Why don't we just hold that thought until we hear from a couple other folks and see where we go. Who wants to come up next?
Thank you.
Why don't you both come up? We'll solve it that way. Let me just, because we have a couple newer members on this committee, they may or may not recall that the last time we proposed a fee increase in this from this committee, it got pounded around the head and shoulders on the floor and ultimately was sent to the Ways and Means Committee. And I guess I hope I've learned something from that experience. But I also want to anticipate what I know will be a very large cry of anguish from my colleagues in the bar at any increase in filing fees, particularly a 25% increase. So that would cause me personally to hesitate. Who wants to be next? Mr. Snyder?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. Mr. Chair, I apologize. I was out of the room when other folks testified, and so I don't want to repeat what they said. But the 245-1 amendments are the result of the deliberations of a task force jointly created by the Judicial Department and the Association of Oregon Counties with participation by the State Bar. With respect to the amount of the increase in the filing fee, it is up to 25%, and it's established by each county based on the circumstances of that county. In any case, it's always entirely dedicated to court security. With respect to the question of the way we structured it, originally Senate Bill 245 provided for the Chief Justice to establish standards, which then each advisory committee in each judicial district, or each county rather, would have to follow. The direction that the task force took on this rather was to say, let's let each of these individual counties, each individual circuit judge in each county, working through that task force, establish what the priorities are for that county, given the list of criteria that are set forth in the rest of the bill. So it was our sense that this could, each of these special plans then could be written to reflect whatever the highest need is for that particular building in order to provide the security that's necessary for the courts within that facility. And since I don't know what everybody else says, I guess that's all I have to say. We recommend it. The task force recommends the amendment.
Okay. Paul, I assume you're the expert on county courthouses. Is there business other than civil judicial business conducted in county courthouses?
Yes, Mr. Chair, there is.
Why should not those parties bear the cost of security in a courthouse?
I think, Mr. Chair, it's a matter of what's available and where the priorities lie for everybody. There is a risk of security problems for everybody, but the driving force behind it is usually what's going on in the courtroom. So this is an effort on everybody's part to come up with a funding mechanism that's acceptable to both sides, and we're giving up part of our existing revenues for county corrections assessments. And given what's going on in other committees as we speak, including what's probably going to happen in the corrections department budget, counties are going to need every nickel of that they can get. But we see this as a high enough priority to shift those funds to this issue as well.
Okay. Mr. Williamson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Charles Williamson. I represent the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. We support the idea of better security in the courthouse. We agree that it's necessary. We very much oppose having civil litigants pay 90%, as I understand the figures, of the cost of the increased security. Why some poor person that's injured that has to go to court to recover for their injuries should be paying for a courthouse security is beyond me. That it's something the public should pay for, and the people that happen to have the unfortunate experience of having to go to court should not have to pay for the. By and large, the civil litigants are not the cause of the security problems in the courthouse, we feel it's grossly unfair to increase filing fees to them to pay for this. If you do determine that you do want civil litigants to pay for this, right now defendants pay about half of the filing fees that plaintiffs pay for, and we would not oppose this bill if you increase defendants' filing fees to be the same as the plaintiffs' filing fees and dedicated the increase to fund courthouse security. but we would oppose the funding mechanism picking on civil litigants to pay for really virtually all the courthouse security this bill provides for. I'd be glad to try and answer your questions.
Okay, questions for these witnesses?
One.
Yes, Senator Shoemaker.
Charlie, what is a typical filing fee? And I'm sorry that I'm ignorant of that.
Well, it varies from county to county depending on what other assessments are in there. Right. I think in Multnomah County, a divorce is about $200. A regular civil case is somewhere around $110. The filing, that's in circuit court. I haven't filed a district court case recently, but that's roughly it.
Okay, further questions for these witnesses? Okay, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Any other witnesses on 245 or 625? Mr. Olson, let me make sure I got it right here. On behalf of the bar, you're supporting this filing fee increase? Just want to make sure I got my instructions here correctly.
Mr. Chairman, I know
I'm going to hear about it later. I want to make sure I get this down very carefully.
As we said before, we are looking for an acceptable way to fund the proposal that we put in conjunction with the Judicial Department, 245. These amendments represent a major step in that direction and would provide money. I don't think today we'd go much further in reaching agreement among the parties in terms of the level of funding. So the final decision on that will be a funding decision probably late in the session. And so that's why we talk about the concept of this kind of arrangement and having some increase. We talked before, I think, when we were here about a partnership between the users and the county and the state. And this may not yet be an even partnership, but there is that aspect of this agreement, and so we generally support that concept.
Okay. And just so I understand where the parties are at on this, and anyone can respond, is if we adopt this, I think the motion, adopt the amendments, I think the motion would then be to send it down to Ways and Means Committee, you know, one way or the other. But if I'm understanding Mr. Linden correctly, he doesn't, and I'm not being critical, if he gets the money, he feels he ought to be able to continue to argue for what he feels the Judicial Department priorities are as opposed to the specific purpose designated here. Bill, am I understanding?
Mr. Chairman, that's accurate. If there is interest in new court-related revenues, our first suggestion to the Ways and Means Committee and to the legislature generally will be then spend those new revenues on in lieu of the expenditure reductions that are in mind. And then if everything is held whole, then we can start looking at new applications of new revenues.
Okay, that's fair. Just wanted to make sure I hit that right, too. Thank you. Okay, you're excused. I guess I've expressed a personal opinion, but that doesn't stand in the way of the committee necessarily. I mean, it's really up to the will of the members. If they want to proceed with the amendment, see where the votes are, and then send it on. Or I hear another dissent. Are there folks who aren't prepared to move today? Or
Mr. Chair, I'd certainly be willing to look at confining it to the courtroom. Or, you know, certainly I don't expect to see you know, the health department or anything else that might be in that courthouse facility secure at the expense of litigants. No. Confining language, and perhaps even in Section 4, the plan shall provide the following, maybe in some circumstances, not every one of the components of that plan would have to be identified, most especially with a price tag. So
my sense is it's not quite ready to go. Someone has a contrary opinion, the motion is certainly available to them. But I think this needs a little bit more time and work, folks.
Maybe,
Chair. Senator Shoemaker?
Just for whatever guidance may serve, I tend to agree with Charlie Williamson. I really don't see why civil litigants should be paying for security in criminal courtrooms. I don't see there's any connection there. And the cost of civil litigation is high enough. Why burden it further?
Let's take that as a question that Mr. Neal and Mr. Snyder want to respond to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Shoemaker, Paul Snyder, for the record, representing Association of Oregon Counties. My understanding from people that I've talked with about the security problems is that the greater risk by far comes in domestic relations case than it does in criminal cases.
And let's impose it on domestic relations filings and not personal injury suits and property damage disputes and those sorts of things. Relate it to the cause, if you will. But.
Mr. Chair, Senator Shoemaker, Fred Neal, Multnomah County Intergovernmental Relations Officers, I would just buttress what Paul said. It's the people getting divorces who create the risk, not the people getting marriage licenses. The county clerk doesn't feel physically threatened by someone coming in off the street to transact business with the county clerk in the courthouse. It's the litigants and, in particular, the members of the judiciary and their staffs that feel most at risk, and that may or may not be primarily in domestic relations cases. The most tragic instances that have occurred in Clackamas, Washington, Multnomah counties in the last decade have, in fact, been in domestic relations issues. There's also a potential of violence in other cases, both civil and criminal, to try to distinguish those and take a Tom Metzger trial and try and peg some relationship of security to an overall, the needs of the sundry of court rooms and court house facilities and judicial facilities, say within Multnomah County's courthouse, and then to peg that to each of those individual filing fees based on the type of litigation, I think belies the need to address security overall for the judicial system. In regards to Senator Hamby's concern in Section 4, and about security overall for the courthouse versus those of judicial activity, Section 4 out of the task force, which I sit on, really focus strictly on the judicial activities that occur in there. There is some reference to the public at large in subparagraph D of subsection 1 of Section 4, but the rest of the reference and the guiding principles under the statute, if you choose to carry it forward, and it gets that far, is to concentrate on the safety of the judicial system, and so that it can proceed with some certainty that it is.
Okay, thank further you. Questions, comments? I think we got to move along here. 240, Senate Bill 240.
Thank you,
I've been assured that this is a 5-minute matter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Dash 12 amendments will be handed out to you in a second. And this is a bill that relates to the statute of limitations, ultimate statute reposes in silicone injections. And I would address your attention in particular to a memo to the Senate Judiciary Committee from Diana Godwin dated March 31, 1993. And what these amendments do is they incorporate the Dash 9 and 10 amendments before us the last time, plus some additional minor changes, but they take out from the original bill the issue of products liability extending beyond the issue of breast implants, and also remove doctors from the bill also. So the bill, as amended and passed out, would not affect doctors, nor would it affect other issues in product liability beyond silicone implants, breast implants, not other kinds of silicone implants.
Okay, we're getting Dash 11 amendments. Should we disregard those or those?
Shouldn't they be the Dash 12?
Yes.
Okay.
Look at 12.
I got a copy of Dash 11 amendments. Disregard those.
It should be the Dash 12.
I understand there's a Dash 12 that was arrived just before the hearing.
Yeah. Okay.
I have the Dash 12, so.
Okay. Thank you. Let's get everybody up here. Who else? Mr. Gallant, Mr. Gardner, I think you folks have been kind of identified with some interest in this legislation, so.
Mr. Chair, if I could, at an earlier meeting, I read into the record a statement that I'd like to read again, and this is to make sure that we do not, in adopting these amendments, make any legislative history that's contrary to what's been proposed. And it says, in amending Section 5 of Senate Bill 240 in the manner suggested by the Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association, it is not the intent of the Oregon Legislative Assembly to change the pre-existing case law governing the application of the statute of limitations or the statute of repose in any cases except those involving medical devices specifically mentioned in Section 2 and Section 4 of Senate Bill 240. On the contrary, it is the intent of the Oregon Legislative Assembly not to change the pre-existing case law except regard to actions involving medical devices specifically mentioned in Sections 2 and Sections 4 of Senate Bill 240.
Okay. Who wants to be next? Diana?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Diana Godwin, representing the law firms of Williams and Troutman. I thank the committee for its patience in bringing this bill back before you. As amended, I have handed out a hand-engrossed Senate Bill 240, which incorporates the Dash 12 amendment. So this is what the bill will look like, word for word, once the Dash 12 amendments are adopted. In that form, the bill, as Mr. Taylor outlined for you, addresses the liability of manufacturers for breast implants only, which contain silicone, silicon, or silica. It exempts those devices from the 8-year statute of
written comments as well.
Before the record, I'm Dave Phillips, section manager at the Department of Revenue. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Department of Revenue isn't taking a position on this bill for or against, but we think that it does raise some significant policy issues that we'd like to comment on. Currently, the statutes that govern the collection of debts by the Department of Revenue allow for the collection of debts owed only to state agencies, and this bill obviously requires that we collect debts owed to individuals and changes that policy. This puts us further into the individual lives of people in the state and in between individuals in conflict in some way. In the area of child support, support enforcement, we currently offset support enforcement where government funds have been expended and remit those to support enforcement. So apart from this changing public policy so that we become a collection agency for individuals, The second issue is one of confidentiality. The individual tax return information is treated as confidential information, and as a general practice, we don't disclose information from these returns except in very limited instances. We do provide that information in support enforcement cases to support enforcement division. There is When you go into the area then of providing this information to attorneys and to the obligee in this case, we think this then really creates some kind of conflict in relation to the confidentiality statutes. There's also the potential for a problem with confidentiality in our relationship with the Internal Revenue Service. We receive tapes from the Internal Revenue Service and we have an agreement with them that requires us to keep information confidential. Once that information is in our data system, we have no idea where it came from, if it came off of a tax return that we received or if it came from the federal government. And there is a chance of disclosing information that we got from the Internal Revenue Service and jeopardizing our relationship with them because of confidentiality issues. The other area where this might impact is in collection of general fund. The taxpayer now has some kind of sense that the information on the tax return is confidential information. It is kept that way except in rare instances, and in this case, there could be an impact on individuals on the filing of their tax returns if they felt like the information was not going to be held confidential.
Okay. Did you want to respond to a couple of the earlier questions raised by Senator Shoemaker in terms of who holds a hearing if there's a challenge or a question, and what the time frame is for resolution of those issues?
I don't have an answer to that in these types of cases because we don't collect them. Currently, debts that are sent to the Department of Revenue for collection are certified by the agency to be liquidated debts, and they've had any hearing process they're entitled to before we get the debt. As a result, we don't go to hearing on them. They're referred back to the other agency.
What if someone says, hey,
you got the wrong guy. You send it back to the collecting agency?
Well, we would be responsible for any actions that we had taken. If we did get the wrong guy, we would be responsible for that. But as a matter of fact, we're changing our system, and in the future, we will not be holding monies for the 30 days that we currently hold them. We will be remitting those to the agency immediately, and if there is a problem, they will remit the monies back and hold a hearing.
Send them to the agency.
We are a collection agency.
Okay. I think I got that picture. Yes, sir.
I'm Bill Cockrell from Adult and Family Services, Adult and Family Services, Human Resources. The written testimony actually is not mine, it's Phil Yarnell, who is my supervisor. We also, like Revenue, are taking no official position on this bill, but there are two or three things we wanted to point out as just issues that are of concern. Number one, if we in Adult and Family Services actually put the information on tape and send it to Revenue, we can do that on 4D cases, which Title 4D of the Social Security Act, where we get federal money. If it's a non-4D case, which the private ones would be, the federal government wouldn't participate that cost, so we would lose 66% of that cost and be general fund money. The second thing is we in AFS or DHR would have no way of certifying those arrears, and that'd have to be done either through a private attorney or some outside source. We wouldn't be able to do that. And neither could we hold a hearing. Currently, the issue of hearings come up two or three times. Currently, Adult and Family Services has a hearings unit that does hold hearings on contested claims. And they, I don't know how many we hold, probably 20 or 30 a year, not many. Third thing is people can go directly to the district attorney and apply. Usually it's a one-time $1 fee for applying for child support services, and they become automatically eligible for not only the Department of Revenue offset, but the IRS offset as well. And that's basically my testimony.
Okay, questions for these witnesses? Okay, if not, thank you, gentlemen. Anyone else on Senate Bill 502? Okay, I would ask or recommend to the sponsors that they connect with these two folks pronto and see if there's some way to resolve these questions or any issues that have arisen as a result of their testimony, and then report back to the committee when you think we're ready to hear this again. Okay? Okay, 2411. We ask the parties to step from the room and see if they could come up with some language that
Mr. Chair,
we get this bill moving. How are we doing?
I have some language here suggested from Paul Snyder here, which on page 2 of the amendment, line 2, after the word account, would add, the report shall be submitted within 30 days of the convening of each regular legislative session and shall be delivered to the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee and to the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, period.
Sounds fine.
Okay.
I would move that amendment to the dash 2 amendment.
Okay. Senator Shoemaker has so moved the amendment to the dash 2 amendments. Any objection?
And move the dash 2 amendments as so amended.
Great. Senator Shoemaker moves the dash 2 amendments as so amended. Any objection? If not,
and move the bill as amended. Two ways and means?
Yes.
Okay. It's got that by
prior
reference. Terms. Okay. Then the motion would be to send 2411 do pass as amended to the Ways and Means Committee. Further discussion? Okay, if not, the clerk will please call the roll.
Senator Hamby?
Aye.
Senator Rasmussen?
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
Aye.
Chair Springer?
Aye. Motion's adopted. Okay, well, notwithstanding the relating clause on that bill, I hope it doesn't get into any trouble down there.
Can we tighten it?
No. We can't do anything to a House bill.
Oh.
But I'm sure it's in good hands in Ways and Means. Famous last words, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Any further business to come before the committee? Oh, did we call the roll on that last motion? If not,
yes.
We did? Okay, great.
That's done. Anything else to come before the committee? Well, okay, I guess we technically are in recess until 5:30. This hearing room?
He's from my L.A.
Yes.
We'll check my L.A.
C, hearing room C at 5:30. Great. Thank you.